Here we are. I'm really delighted to be here. And we're actually going to start a demo fairly early, just so that you guys can start to get a sense. Those of you who have maybe just been exposed through the preview course, or maybe through the book, perhaps, or have heard me speak publicly in some other venue, but I haven't really had the chance to see the effectiveness of this particular approach. So think about whether or not you'd be willing to speak about your journey with your own critical inner voice as I do our intro and just say a little bit about what we'll be doing tonight. So transforming critical inner voice, week one. And this week we'll be learning about the left and the right hemispheres, which are my favorite thing to teach about and learn about because they're so essential for really learning nonviolent communication deeply. I have a beloved friend who wrote to me last week that getting a sense of the left and the right hemispheres has given her new hope for a connection with her family. She's been studying NVC for maybe 10 years. And so it was incredibly sweet to hear that this kind of solid ground for understanding the way that relational language makes us flexible and fluid, and non-relational or instrumental language just kind of leaves us static, gives us a little bit more of a sense of the pickle that we might find ourselves in with the self-critical voice, but also gives us a little bit of a sense of the pickle that our world is in. We'll be talking about self-regulation versus self-management, and we'll be, throughout the call, doing our best to foster the experience of accompaniment and self-warmth. So those of you who were with me on the preview call, which may not be everybody, will remember that we were talking about how warmth and precision equal resonance. There are a lot of definitions of the word empathy. Empathy is a beautiful word, and in the world of nonviolent communication, empathy means coming into a place where we have a deep and sweet wondering about other people's feelings and needs. But the rest of the world uses this word empathy quite differently than we use it in nonviolent communication. For example, recently there was some research studied that showed the negative effects of empathy. This is what you'll often see now. The negative effects of empathy. People become burned out, and it's because they don't have these skills of warmth and precision. And the way that they're practicing their compassion takes them so far into the other person's experience without any grounding that they become exhausted as well. So the precision and the care and the warmth all really come together to create an experience that is sweet for the person receiving, and really sweet and calming for the person who is offering themselves as a way to create a resonant field with another. And so before we go any farther, we're just going to dive into the demo. Who is willing? So go ahead and tell me a little bit about your journey with the critical self-witness.
So I was introduced sort of this kind of language through nonviolent communication, and became aware, like increasingly aware of this critical voice that I have. I mean, I think I knew that for many years, but I never knew how to manage it. I'm not sure. I feel kind of nervous. I'm not really sure what to share.
In this moment, what would you most wish for yourself in regards to the critical voice?
I would just really like to have it be a lot quieter and be able to live more in this like creative, playful, joyful place. And largely what I notice, it comes up a lot around work, and I'm a facilitator and a trainer at work. So I have a lot of stimulus that seems to be happening at times when I'm not feeling very centered, and I'm becoming increasingly aware of how much it kind of can impact my ability to be present and engage with people.
So you'd like it to be a lot quieter.
I'd like it to be really gone.
Really gone. What does it say? When is the last moment when you heard it, and what did it say?
Oh, just like, why did you raise your hand, you big, like, hog of time for everybody? Put your hand down.
Okay, there's one example. Can you think of another one?
Today at work, I had a meeting with my supervisor, and everything really went well, but she said, I have two things to share with you. And immediately I was like, oh my God, you are in such trouble and you better figure out what the hell's, you know, you've done wrong. Even though nothing, I mean, it was two positive things she wanted to share.
Okay. So first of all, does your body need acknowledgement that when you were a little one, you didn't often hear good things? So mostly what you heard when people started to talk to you were not good things.
Yeah.
And then if we were to say to your body, no wonder you are expecting to hear something bad. Of course you would be expecting that. What happens?
Like a critical voice comes over the top of that.
What does it say?
Oh, you big baby. Everybody has a tough life.
Okay. So I'm just kind of sinking in here because we'll be learning about this over the course of the weeks, but the way we use our critical voice with ourselves is often to try to turn down our life volume. It's almost like when we touch this critical self-witness, we're starting to touch the question of whether or not we really believe that our life energy is a gift on this planet. Or if we believe that we need to be quite a bit quieter and exist less. Because we were hearing that a little bit in the first example when your critical voice said, don't raise your hand, get your hand down, pull it down. What are you doing? So as I'm saying this, what happens for you?
Well, I was trying to pay attention to your words. And then I was noticing all of the faces that I can see. And I noticed some like feelings of worry. And I was like, oh, they're probably thinking, I wish you'd shut up. You're hogging all the time. And then now I saw somebody smile and I'm like, oh, I bet they're not thinking that at all. Ugh.
So am I understanding that putting yourself into the world is really fraught with vulnerability?
Yes. And I keep doing it.
Yay. Hooray for the persistence. Yeah.
Yeah.
So for the one that says, don't raise your hand, what are you doing? Does this voice need acknowledgement that two possibilities? One is, are you not sure there's enough for everybody?
No, it's more like I'm sure there's enough for everybody but me.
And I just need to know if you had siblings.
Yeah, two older brothers and one younger brother.
Remind me again of the gift you'd like to give yourself. You'd like this voice to be gone. You'd like to turn down the volume or you'd like it to be gone.
Yeah.
So critical voice of Maja, are you trying to keep Maja safe? Are you trying to keep her safe from disappointment? From the disappointment of extending your life energy into the world and not being met? Not being welcome?
Yeah, I think disappointment and like vulnerability or protect her from...
Disappointment. Protect her from disappointment and vulnerability. What happens for your body? How's your body? How's the voice doing? What's it saying now? What's coming across?
Just kind of like, okay, I'm trying to figure you out, figure out where you're going, like with this.
What I'd like to do with this is to get enough of a sense of the way that the critical voice responds to being understood with warmth and precision, that your body gets to relax a little bit, that we get to turn the volume down on the voice and provide a bit of an example of a different way to be with the critical voice and to have some stuff that we can reference as we starting to build understanding moving forward. Is that okay?
Yeah. So I think, you know, like in this scenario, like, okay, well, this is great. You can be safe and vulnerable here and tell people, but you know, like the critical voice, you got to be careful out in the world because, you know, and it's not even really stuff I believe, really, but it's like all this, whatever, people are just manipulative and cruel and they're going to hurt you and, you know, are just out for themselves. And you better learn how to play the game because you're just like this like pie in the sky optimist dreamer that
yeah,
good at everyone.
So we're hearing so much care. Let me check. Are we hearing so much care to try to keep Maja from being disappointed?
Yeah, I think so. Because it's like when people come back with kind of like what I show them and they come back with whatever might be like their own sense of disappointment or whatever people say, like, don't get your hopes up or that'll never happen. I just feel so sad.
Yeah.
Like wounded almost.
Yeah. Would you like to live in a world where hope was encouraged?
Yeah. Yeah. And like the first thing like out of people's mouths when you just like share this exciting thing or whatever, and they're like, well, that will never work.
Yeah.
Or, you know, yeah, but that's, you got to live in the real world kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I just feel like I just kind of shrink in and I get silent because I, mm-hmm. and I just feel like I don't belong anywhere then.
Yeah. So what we're, I think maybe a bit of the pattern that we're holding together, and I think this is going to be true as we'll see throughout this course for so many people, is this sort of like we are little magical beings who are bringing something that's very beautiful. And the experience of not being met or being told, that'll never work, you know, receiving that, it kind of makes the petals of the opening being cringe and shrink and turn black with the kind of contamination of hopelessness and contempt. And so one of the things that we do as humans is we preemptively create a critical voice that will keep us small enough that we won't uncurl our petals. Then there's no danger of us receiving these difficult messages in response. I mean, one of the common experiences that I have had, and I just saw Susan's note that says, so much gratitude for Maja's gift of vulnerability. Thank you, Susan, for catching Maja's life energy a little bit. How is it to hear that, Maja?
Yeah.
That it's contributing, that we're learning really deeply because it's intimate and it's important and it's personal and it's foundational for the growing understanding that we're making. So just, I want to check in with your critical voice. How's your critical voice doing, Maja? What's it saying now?
It's just kind of hanging out back here. It's like, oh, this is kind of interesting what she's saying. Uh-huh. We'll see.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Let's check in. See what all this means. Yeah. So in this moment, we got the volume turned down a little bit since it's hanging out in the back. As we move through the course, there are going to be a couple of opportunities to look at the nervous system contracts that we make with ourselves. So you can say to me right now, if you'd like me to ask a question about a nervous system contract or if this is enough for today, just let me know what's your sense.
I feel kind of intrigued.
Okay. This is a way to think about the deep needs that we're meeting with the self-critical voice. And since we'll be talking about self-regulation and self-management, this will start to make more sense to everybody as we go through. But here's the question. Have you made a promise to yourself that would be something like, I, Maja, solemnly swear, and this is like a formal legalese language that helps us touch the deep needs that are alive in self-criticism. I, Maja, solemnly swear to my essential self that I will remain forever vigilant of ways in which Maja might extend herself that might place her in danger of not belonging in order to make sure that she survives, no matter the cost to myself. Would it be something like that?
Yeah. I mean, at first I thought you were like saying I was going to make a contract to do the opposite. And I was like, oh, hold on. We're not doing that. We're not making any kind of contract to.
No, this is naming an existing contract.
Yeah.
This is naming the contract you've been living with, the deep needs that your nervous system is meeting by having a self-critical voice. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. I was realizing, I don't know when you use the word contract.
We'll talk about that more. Yeah.
My creative voice is like, don't admit anything to her.
We will not be able to do our job if she talks to us.
That's right. If she knows too much about the contract.
Yeah. And there can be contracts not to talk to. And we'll talk about those as we go on. There can be, you know, contracts not to reveal family secrets. Like there are these layers of needs that we're meeting with these behaviors that we think of as self-sabotaging or unpleasant. Or it's really an interesting place to go, to go, what needs am I really meeting by being this self-critical?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, I'm just going to kind of give you the fork in the road. Have we gone far enough for tonight? Or do you want to override the self-critical voice saying, don't tell her anything?
Well, I guess I'm wondering, like, I don't want to, and I don't know that this is so much critical, but I, you know, I do enjoy like hearing from other people and stuff. So I guess I'd want to give other people a chance.
Okay, then we'll have people express some needs. And Monica wrote bravery. I always love the way that bravery can be a need met for inspiration. Shared reality from Sarah Ann. Thank you. Maybe get 3 or 4 more needs that were met. Need met for courage and transparency. Thank you. So I'll just read those back to you one more time. Solidarity, transparency, courage, shared reality, bravery, vulnerability, authenticity, companionship. How's your body doing?
Well, it was great. I was like, wow, this is nice. And then I had a critical thought. Be careful, you might get killed.
So we need to acknowledge how vulnerable the good things, you know? It's like so vulnerable to become the demo person. It's so vulnerable to hear the needs met. It's like it might even be violating our needs for integrity in terms of everybody having access. So I just want to thank you so much for stepping out, because you're opening for us this beautiful question that we're here to answer, which is what are the deep needs that we are meeting with our self-critical voice? Thank you. Anything else you'd like to say before we transition?
Yeah, just thank you, everyone, for your words of support, and thank you. I guess I want to say one thing. Like, when I listened to the free intro video the other day, I was just so blown away, and I had a critical voice as I was trying to get out the door. I was late. I tried this, like, I'm not listening to you, critical voice. I remember you have no mercy or compassion. Get to the back of my head. I'm going to live over here in creativity as I walk out the door and have fun today. And I sent that video to a lot of my friends and people at work saying, check this out. It was amazing. So thank you.
Thank you much. So sweet to know. And then I want to add that Chell wrote, need met for not having to know the answers. So now, what I want to talk about next is this question of self-management versus self-regulation. Just to give you a quick sense about what's supposed to happen in brains. Now, the reason that we know that these things are supposed to happen in brains is because children for whom these things happen end up with less cortisol overall, easier lives overall, and longer lifespans with fewer injuries and fewer diseases. So, what is supposed to happen for humans and gives them these good things is that they have an emotional experience. Here's the model of the brain in the palm of the hand that Daniel Siegel does, with this being the spinal column coming up to the brainstem, with the thumb folded across representing the limbic system, which is deep inside the brain, and then the fingers folded down around the thumb. See how we can gently, you can do this yourselves, you can kind of gently. When I first learned this, I used to cram my thumb down into my thumb, like, gently, gently. And what happens is that when the child has an emotional experience, the parent's brain wraps around it a little bit and kind of says, yeah, of course you're scared. That was a loud noise, huh? But it's okay. There's nothing wrong. That was just the wind blowing a shutter. You know, it's like there's an acknowledgement of what happened. And there's warmth and precision about why it would make sense. And when that happens, the child calms. There's a sense of being calmed. And as the child goes through life, they carry with them this internal parent for the rest of their lives that kind of holds them with warmth and care. So happily, no matter how old we are, this learning is completely available to us. So every time we have a sense of being understood with some warmth and precision, then what happens is we're building these very fibers, we're growing these fibers that run between prefrontal cortex and amygdala and nestle and hold the amygdala. Now, the reason that this is important to know is because we're now going to talk about the common ways that humans use to bring themselves back into balance. And one of the ways that people come back into balance is to identify and name their feelings. The people who do this research don't know about needs. So they don't know the incredible calming that comes with doing feelings and needs. I have written to Matthew Lieberman and asked him to do a little research into needs, but I have not received a reply from him yet. Another way that humans bring themselves back to balance is to reframe the way that they're thinking about a situation. So a common reframing is if you're driving on the freeway and somebody cuts you off and it's really scary and you had to slam on your brakes in order not to hit them, and you think, oh, I'm sure they are trying to get to the hospital or they just had an emergency. We try to think about the situation differently. That's a very common way for humans to self-regulate. People also use distraction as a way to self-regulate. So they will, for example, distract themselves by moving right into a mindfulness meditation when they know that they're upset, or they'll drink water when they know they're upset, or something that allows them to distract themselves. It can be an external, as we will see in a moment, or an internal distraction. And then also another way to come back into balance is the real or imagined presence of a warm resource person. There's one more way that we as humans come back into balance, and that is with nonviolent communication empathy, with this kind of an approach of feelings and needs guesses. And we'll expand resonant language beyond just feelings and needs guesses, because feelings and needs guesses are hidden inside every kind of language that supports well-being and supports connection and supports resonance. So we'll be talking about that in more detail. A lot of us teach and take classes on stealth giraffe or street giraffe. Any resonant language, any right hemisphere language takes us into this place where the little one gets to have a sense of being known and held. So there are two main ways that we have of being in the world. And one of these is the left hemisphere experience, and one of these is the right hemisphere experience. And we could say that the left hemisphere is like the lone hero, and the right hemisphere is resonant holding. The left and the right hemispheres of the brain are actually shaped slightly differently. The internal structure of the left and the right hemisphere are actually different too. The way that the left hemisphere creates connection with other neurons looks a lot like a bunch of ladders. And the right hemisphere looks like a bunch of webbing. So the left hemisphere is not really a relational place. The left hemisphere doesn't see other people as really existing. The left hemisphere sees us all as individuals. Everybody's a lone hero. Everybody's got their function. You connect with other people to take advantage of what they can do for you. The right hemisphere sees the world in a very different way. The right hemisphere sees the world as a place of mystery. It sees other people as a kind of a collection of souls, as unpredictable, as infinite, instead of as being tools that will allow us to get what we need. Throughout the animal kingdom, the right hemisphere actually weighs more than the left hemisphere. For a long time, scientists believed that the right hemisphere didn't really do anything, that it was just kind of a dark place. And this was because our language centers are in the left hemisphere. So any time that we open our mouths and start to talk, we actually are encouraging a shift to the left, a shift out of relational space. This is one of the reasons that it's so important to know that the right hemisphere is what we want to bring to life in our relational connections, that we want to use language that allows us to move into relational space despite the gravitational pull of the left hemisphere for us to turn other people into tools. Now, I want to say a few words about the self-critical witness in relationship with these hemispheres. I want to say that our left hemisphere is our self-critical witness. It is the part that compares, that criticizes, that blames. So Leslie had asked about blaming others or being critical of others. The left hemisphere cannot integrate new information by itself. It goes into denial when it's faced with new information. So if you think about this on a global scale, it may be that there are some brains that have a really difficult time accepting global climate change. And the only way that those brains can accept any kind of global climate change is by blame. So, for example, if there was a person who did not believe in global climate change, but they could blame the sinful humans for their actions that would bring a wrathful God down with storms, then they could integrate global climate change. Do you see how one of the things that we need in this world is we need the right hemisphere? Without the right hemisphere, humanity is sucking pond water. So left hemisphere, right hemisphere, the blaming of others is a way for us to deal with a world that is immensely painful, that we have not yet been supported in mourning about. So Leslie, what's it like for you to hear me talking about the left hemisphere and criticism of others?
It makes sense because my right hemisphere is not engaged when I'm critical of myself and others, it seems. I don't feel any warmth. I just feel like judgmental.
And if we were going to support you to be able to mourn what you needed to mourn, what would be there that needs to be mourned?
A lot of it lately has been about conservation and taking care of things, being aware of overuse of resources and excessive about caring for the planet. I'm mourning how people that are college educated aren't even aware of basic concepts that I believe in.
Right. So this is a huge mourning.
Yeah.
This is a mourning about life itself on planet Earth.
Yeah, and people that I live with, you know, in the same house.
Yeah, so I'm hearing that there's a global mourning for the planet. And there's a personal mourning, maybe because you would really love to share a deep care for the earth with the people that you live with every day.
Yes.
You would love shared values?
Yes.
What's happening as we're starting to just open this door, and thank you for stepping through it with me a little bit. How's the critical voice doing?
Well, I'm more in touch with the mourning than the critical voice. Like how tragic it is to buy all this shit from Amazon and the local businesses will go out of business. Whatever the issue is, there's so many right now.
So it sounds like you have a worry about the planet that we're catching, a longing for a warm community that has shared values in your own home. And it sounds like you also are really wanting people to see the consequences of their actions at multiple levels.
Yes, and take care of things. Take care of what's just directly around them. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Almost like a longing for guardianship or stewardship.
Yes, definitely.
Uh-huh. How's your body doing?
I feel like I'm being understood.
Uh-huh. What happens physically when you're understood?
I'm noticing a relaxation.
Thank you very much.
Feeling more grounded.
Thank you. I'll invite people to type me their needs met for you into the chat, and I'll go on from here. But I'm really grateful that you are willing to share this with us because it's so important to begin to see this in our daily lives. I'm really grateful. Thank you. So if we're starting to think about self-care, the way that the left hemisphere likes to do self-care is it likes to have a way to fix things. It really wants a good strategy. But at the same time, because our strategies, I love this about Marshall Rosenberg, that he would say that if we can really get to the needs that are alive, then the strategies will kind of blossom out of those. So even though the left hemisphere really wants strategies, most often when you're in dialogue with the left hemisphere and you're offering the left hemisphere strategies, it's going to say, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, I can't do that. Yeah, but, you don't understand. I can't do that. Yeah, but, yeah, but. So one of the things we get to do with the right hemisphere language is address the deeper issues, just as we were kind of sinking into that with Leslie was a beautiful example. And we'll come back to some of the things. So the right hemisphere view of self-care is very different than strategic. It's kind of about, if we clear the space for self-care, what will feel right? Will it feel right to go for a walk? Will it feel right to have a bath? Will it feel right to take a nap? Will it feel right to have nourishing food? That's kind of the movement that happens when the right hemisphere gets to be fully, fully, fully supported, which is something that doesn't happen a lot in our Western world. So self-criticism is a way to blame. It is a way to blame the self. The left hemisphere has a really difficult time integrating new information. It's a little bit like the left hemisphere neurons are a tiny army, and they have a lot of capacity to march. The left hemisphere is run by the fuel of dopamine, which is the brain's neurotransmitter for seeking and action. So the left hemisphere is like this little marching army that just wants to go straight ahead. It really has a hard time changing, you know, from one lane to another on the highway. It has a hard time shifting gears. It has a hard time changing strategies. What the left hemisphere believes, and we know this from split hemisphere experiments where people have had to have their hemispheres separated to be able to control epilepsy, or when people have had major car accidents or tumors that have taken out the right side of the brain. And what we know is that the left hemisphere needs, in order to integrate something new, it needs to be able to blame somebody. And it can blame others. It doesn't really like to blame the self, but it will learn to blame the self if that is supportive of the person becoming smaller. There's this really key thing that happens when we want to either protect ourselves from shame and disappointment, or the disappointment of not being met and not being welcome, or when we're trying to balance somebody else's nervous system. So if, for example, we have a mother who is depressed, she's not able to be in response to us. So we try to become as small as possible in order to take up as little space as possible so that maybe we get to have a little relational connection with a mama who's overloaded. So one of the ways that we become small is by the danger of having been attacked. And another way that we become small is the effort to balance somebody else's nervous system. We'll be talking about this over the course of these weeks, but I'm just following the unfolding of this understanding in my own self as well as trying to bring it to you. So the word confabulation is a wonderful word, a plausible yet imaginary memory that fills in gaps in what is remembered. The trauma of aloneness is rarely available for conscious understanding and memory. It is the sea in which we swim. Most of us have no idea that we were alone as little ones. It's like the learning that this path takes us on is very similar to what we were doing with Leslie, where we got to touch into the deep mournings that were lying below the criticism of others. One of the things we begin to understand when we work in this way with the self-critical witness and we're looking at the deep needs below the action of self-criticism is that we begin to understand that self-criticism is the way the brain copes with being left entirely emotionally alone. Emotional aloneness is not readily apparent to the naked eye because so often we have parents who are able to be warm, who are able to be, or to seem warm, to seem loving, even to be warm and to be loving, but they don't have the precision of understanding us. If we receive warmth, but no precision of understanding, then we're alone. if we receive just strategies. So, for example, if your mother always had dinner on the table at 5 o'clock, if there was always the right time to brush your teeth, if everybody always got their homework done, if everybody always got out the door at the right time to catch the school bus, then we'd know that all of those kind of I's were being dotted and the T's were being crossed. But what we don't know and don't understand is that in that, again, sort of precision and warmth, there's a precision about time, but there's not a warmth. There's a precision about what needs to be gotten done, but there's not a warmth. So we're kind of working with the ways in which both warmth and precision need to be present for a child to have a sense of being accompanied. It is not until we see the bars of the cage for what they are, frozen moments of loneliness, that we start to understand the explanatory value of the left hemisphere's confabulations about self. So the common ideas that we have, that we hear, when we're listening to the left hemisphere in its attitude towards us, are the false core beliefs that you find that we work with so often in nonviolent communication. Ideas about, I am alone. Ideas about, I can't trust anyone. Nobody cares about me. Nobody wants to reach for me. I'm not worthy of being loved. I hurt people or I harm those I love. No matter what I do, no one will ever listen to me. I will never be wanted. It's always my fault. I can't get it right. If only I were different, I would understand. I must do things perfectly or there's no point in trying. I must not show my feelings. I wonder if as we're looking at these, you're starting to see the loneliness that's here in these ideas about the self.
There's a couple of comments in the chat.
Oh, okay. Go ahead and read them to us.
One says, Sarah, what is the neuroscientific reason for the left hemisphere blaming to integrate new information?
What is the neuroscientific? I was looking this up today. I was quoting McGilchrist to somebody who wrote to ask me this question. And I can't find the neuroscientific reason, although I find the research that shows that it's true, which is done by Ramachandran. But I think what the neuroscientific reason is that those little left hemisphere soldier neurons do not have the capacity to see the big picture. Seeing the big picture is a right hemisphere experience. And so those little soldier guys are, what's my next order? What's the next order that I need to take? Just tell me what to do next. They're not, you know, oh, we will blame Sarah. It is Sarah should never have done that. Why did she speak? What the heck is she doing leading a teleseminar? These kinds of things. That's my best guess. I'm on the lookout for more research on that.
Then we heard from Stacy asking for trauma and aloneness.
The trauma of aloneness is rarely available to our conscious understanding and memory. It is the sea in which we swim. It's like this fish doesn't know that there's a sea of aloneness. That's just the sea they're swimming in. So they don't know they're alone. It's like we remember our childhoods. We don't know that we're alone because that was our childhood. And it's only as we gradually begin to, you know, kind of build this backward scaffolding to reach into the sea of aloneness where we're starting to look at these words. Oh my God, most of us think one of these things at least. How is that for the people who asked that?
It looks like that was the right one. Resonates, okay. Feel tears welling up.
Oh, were there more questions? Okay. No. The left hemisphere also tries to explain the world to us using blame and confabulation. So it doesn't just have core beliefs about us, it has core beliefs about the world. It says women or men are dangerous, the world's not safe, you can't trust anyone, you can never relax. Our hate-isms and our prejudices and our unconscious racism and our unconscious ageism and the way that we just kind of gloss over entire swaths of humanity as not being worth our attention is all the left hemisphere. And then my friend Mika Maniwa, this is a direct quote, people are fucking nuts and you can never relax. So that made some people laugh. Well, the right hemisphere sees the world in context. And this is a quote from Ian McGilchrist, who wrote the beautiful book, The Master and His Emissary. It is the right hemisphere which has the job of reintegrating the two visions, the vision of the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, these two takes, and trying to hold them together. The right hemisphere always sees more of the picture literally than the left hemisphere, and it is also more able to hold two apparently conflicting pieces of information in mind without having to collapse them into one consistent reality. It can do both and, where the left hemisphere has to have either or. Which is, I think begins to point us toward an understanding that our right hemisphere has to be online in order for us to mourn, because mourning requires both and, whereas blame only requires either or. And we can't really have our right hemisphere fully online unless we have some kind of support to do it. There has to be either support that we've integrated from the past and we're carrying with us, or we have to be in a situation like this where we're holding each other together. So part of the tragedy of aloneness is that it keeps us from our mourning. It keeps us from complexity. So here is another quote from Ian McGilchrist. The presence of the other. The essential difference between the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere is that the right pays attention to the other, whatever it is that exists apart from ourselves, with which it sees itself in profound relation. And that's opposed to disconnection. So the left hemisphere sees us in disconnected rather than in connected relationship. And then there's a wonderful YouTube video from RS Animates, which you are welcome to take a look at. That's the McGilchrist video. For imagination, you need both hemispheres. For reason, you need both hemispheres. You need reason and imagination. And then it says, no shit, Sherlock, and it's reasonable to conclude that we need to live in peace, not in pieces. So this kind of brings us back for a moment to what Majo was longing for, this longing to be able to live in creativity and not to live at the mercy of the merciless left hemisphere. The left hemisphere has no capacity for human understanding. It has no capacity for mercy. If we're trying to get the approval of our left hemisphere, it will always be conditional. It's like trying to get the emotional approval from a robot. Is trying to get the emotional approval from our left hemisphere. To heal, you need both hemispheres. So now we're going to switch gears slightly and talk about the left hemisphere's ways that it tries to come back into balance when it gets upset. If we try to control the outer environment, and we can try to control the inner environment. The word control is a left hemisphere word. The left hemisphere strategy approach, managing the brain by controlling our environment. Ways of external control are here, including acting out with anger, responding with contempt, blaming, bullying, domestic violence, managing somebody else's life. Taking ourselves out of an environment is a way to externally control the environment. Managing somebody else's life, needing home or work environments to be particularly neat or ordered. Workaholism, controlling resources, planning everything. And then internal control. We'll do all kinds of things to try to control our brain and the disrupted places that it gets into when it gets upset. And these are some of the ways that we try to manage with internal control. In other words, by moderating the neurotransmitter picture inside the brain. All of these things are ways that moderate internal brain chemistry. Self-criticism and self-contempt moderate not only internal brain chemistry, but moderate entire bodily states, as we will learn in later weeks. Eating for comfort, drinking alcohol, risky behaviors and sports activities create adrenaline, taking drugs, smoking cigarettes, gambling compulsively, shopping or spending compulsively. All of these items, the risky behaviors, the smoking cigarettes, the gambling compulsively, shopping or spending compulsively, acting out sexually or being addicted to sex, strip clubs or pornography, getting in fights to bluff tension, and workaholism, all manage the left hemisphere. They all manage the flow of dopamine. So it's a little bit like I was teaching some of this stuff in a men's prison in Washington State. And talking to a man about his decades-long IV drug addiction and explaining about internal and external control and how the IV drugs allow a change in the internal brain state, especially heroin, that moves us towards having endogenous opioids and creating a chemical warmth instead of a relational warmth. And he said, What you're telling me is that I have spent the last 20 years of my life fighting this battle in the wrong battlefield. I have been fighting this battle on the level of strategy, trying to create strategies to stop myself from taking IV drugs when I needed to be building up my right hemisphere so that I could hold myself with warmth and have the endogenous opioids and have the warmth without the heroin. So I thought that was a beautiful insight that he had. Another way to manage ourself and our energy is with what we take in by eating. And there's even research that shows that those of us who are perhaps more introverted will use sugar in order to increase our energy levels for social interaction. And then as compared to, as I was mentioning with the story from the prison, managing the brain with the right prefrontal cortex. Here's what we use when we're bringing the right prefrontal cortex to the table instead of the left. Compassion, understanding, gentleness, generosity, seeing the big picture, seeing intentions, acknowledging complexity, responding with precision and warmth, holding torness with care, empathy, mindsight, wisdom, in short, resonance. I'm going to pause for just a moment to see if there are any questions or if anybody's having a need met. I would love to know there are other folks out there. So it could be people can raise their hands or you can write in the chat. I'd love to hear some voices. It would help me feel less alone.
I see need for clarity met, learning, need for communion, learning, all kinds of stuff there. And I see Rob has a hand up.
What I'm getting out of it, Sarah, is that, you know, I'm going through a mourning process with my 7-year relationship, and it's over 2 months now, and I'm doing really good. But what I'm seeing is that my left brain, my left hemisphere strategies were very dominant before the breakup. And with my heart being broken and getting opened and crying daily, the right hemisphere has kicked in. And when I veer towards those left strategies again, thankfully, some feeling comes sometime in the day and it moves me back over to the right. So I'm not engaging in those left brain strategies. What you're elucidating here is really helpful for my internal process.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, and I love hearing your voice. Thanks for speaking up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I see a comment in the chat about voice which says I should die. How does it serve purpose to protect oneself?
Could we talk to this person for a moment? Are they willing to speak?
Your mic is open.
So you have a voice that says you should die?
Yeah, sometimes, and it's quite strong.
So the first thing we need to know is if you needed to limit your life energy in order for your mama to survive.
Yeah, to some extent, I remember clearly that I had to like play it really cool and also cool down my brother and sisters so she wouldn't be triggered with utmost rage and anger. Playing down completely sometimes.
Right. Yeah. So just check. This is moving really quickly, but let's just check for it because we can backtrack. But check for a contract. It would be made when you were really little, so it wouldn't be so much a grown-up contract, but a little person's contract. That would be something like, I solemnly swear to my essential self that I will exist only as much as is needed to keep myself and my brother and sister alive, and no more than that, in order to keep all burden off of my mother and to let my family survive. Does that feel true?
Yeah. It does. Yeah, it does.
Uh-huh.
And I think I kept very much on the survival mode, maybe throughout my life.
Yeah, yeah. So just check and see if you want to go a step further here tonight. Yeah. So then let's have you say it and see what the words are for you. I, Yano, solemnly swear to my essential self.
I, Yano, solemnly swear to my essential self.
That I will keep myself under wraps. I don't know the words exactly. That I will turn myself, my volume down so low.
I will turn myself down so low.
Uh-huh. That I will not be a burden on my mother.
That I will not be a burden on my mother.
No matter the cost to myself.
No matter the cost to myself.
Did we all do okay? Do we need to put back in the part about making sure your brother and sister survive?
That's okay. I mean, like, okay. This is okay already.
So it felt true?
Yes, it does.
Okay. So now we want to check with your essential self. This is like a word that I use for the soul or the spirit or the divine. Is that okay with you, the word essential self?
Yes.
Now yes. I'd like you to kind of step into being Yano's essential self. I'd like you to become her so I can talk to your essential self. Tell me when you have her.
Okay.
Yano's essential self, did you hear the vow that Yano made to you?
Yeah.
Good. Did you like that vow?
Well, no. I mean, I kind of hardly like breathe, actually.
Yeah. Would you please tell Yano, you don't need that vow anymore.
Yano, you don't need that vow anymore.
No. And Yano, I release you from this contract.
Yano, I release you from this contract.
And I revoke this vow.
And I revoke this vow.
Ah, thank you. Yano's essential.
Thank you.
And now just slowly come back to being Yano for me.
It's strange. Like, I feel like crying, but I also feel some shame of some kind. I'm not sure what.
You may need to know that your work is supporting people and seeing this and that it resonates for people. So let's just get a few people to type in what needs are you being met for Yano and me pausing here on this very important question. We got shared reality, healing, companionship, affirmation, connection and healing, and freedom, and humanity and compassion. How is it to hear this, Yano? There's more. Learning in community, self-value, getting it, tenderness, humanness, love for family. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I think I'm aware that other people also experience this. And I know that when I read something of people daring to speak about that, I thank you for saying it.
Yeah. So, and how's the shame doing just in this moment?
It's a little better.
It feels better?
It's not so strong.
Oh, good. Okay. There's also can be kind of this funny experience of strange disorientation when we release these ancient vows. And I'd like you to check back in if you're willing, just to see about this voice that says you should be dead. How's it doing? What's it saying?
It's kind of like I have this image sometimes of like really ugly face, like screaming at me. And right now it feels like it's moving away, you know, like in a movie, moving back. It's still doing it, but like it's moving back. And I see it for what it is, like some kind of monster.
Oh, very wonderful. So what I'd like is just to let you have a moment to watch it move away as far as it's going to go. Just take a moment to let that happen.
Yeah. It looks a bit like, you know, those ugly dinosaur and it's moving away.
Good.
Yes, sometimes I have felt that this dinosaur, this voice is actually my mother and father's voice, you know, that they really wanted me to die.
And children, you know, hear that. They really do. This is not some made up thing. Children receive these words, you know. Yano, would your body like acknowledgement that you were told this?
I don't remember it, but I experience it.
Yeah. There can be a feeling of dizziness or lightheadedness that comes with this too.
Yeah, of dizziness, of being tired also.
Yes. And so in honor of that, we would say, Yano, have you been fighting this battle for a really long time?
Yeah, I guess all my life.
Yeah. Now that we got that scary face a little bit farther away, can you feel how tired you are?
Yeah.
I'd like to invite one more thing before we transition, which is to let your essential self tell you what she would like for you instead of this voice.
Well, to be able to live normally and not feel like a total reject.
Yeah. To live normally. And can I invite maybe even some sweetness into that idea of not having to live like a total reject. Could we invite your essential self to wish for you that you would know that you belong and that you are supposed to be here? that you're in the right place.
I'm so glad I joined. This is the right timing.
Good.
Thank you for that.
Yeah. Like here tonight with us, and then also just like on this earth. You are welcome. Yano, thank you very much, because we're really touching this, that we can take this self-criticism so seriously, that it really is so trying to figure out a way for us to survive in a world that's, as you said, been tough for many. Thank you very much, Yano. Okay, so now we're going to get a little more of the nuts and bolts of left hemisphere language and right hemisphere language. When we want to bring words to resonance, we need to have care, as language is largely used to do things rather than to be things. So we need to move into language that's all about being. If we want to create relational connection, we need to throw out advice, explaining, reframing, problem solving, telling somebody how they feel or how they should feel, denying, dismissing, and criticizing. And here are some of the ways that we can use language that don't take us into the left hemisphere. If we talk about body sensations, we're immediately shifting into the right. If we talk about feelings and needs, if we talk about acknowledgement, if we say words like, of course, Sarah, of course you feel, I'll just do a moment for myself around being sick on the call with all you guys, which I find really embarrassing. Sarah, of course you feel embarrassed. Sarah, are you embarrassed? Because you so want this way of being and living to give people a sense of robust health and well-being. And in this moment, are you imagining that it's a little difficult for people to imagine their own robust health and well-being when you are coming on with the end of a cold? Of course you would feel embarrassed. So there's acknowledgement. Fresh metaphor and simile, poetry and visual imagery, impossible dreams, swear words, and relational language. There's a little mini course that's on my website if you want to kind of dig into this. So if this is lighting you up, there's information about that. And as we go through, I'll point out different times when we're using these different ways of doing resonant language. Tonight, you've been hearing a lot of needs guesses. When we were talking with Leslie, when we were talking with Maja, you were hearing a lot of needs guesses of, you know, do you want to live in a world where, which is sort of a combination of impossible dreams and needs guesses. And remember that I told you that inside every bit of resonant language, there are feelings and needs. I learned this from Holly Humphrey, one of the original trainers with Marshall Rosenberg. And she was the one who first taught me about impossible dreams. And I think began to open the door to this exploration of resonant language. So we'll talk about those more as they come up. So the empathy guess from nonviolent communication, making attunement and resonance verbal. Warm curiosity, bring your warm curiosity. Let yourself really believe and sink into the idea that all feelings make sense and they're arising out of beautiful needs. That empathy guesses are always questions, always end with a question mark. They're open-ended, they're needs versus strategies. We follow the body and the receiver is always sacred. So if you make a needs guess and your person says, no, it's not that, it's this, and you feel like you want to say, no, listen, I think it's this, that's not letting the receiver be sacred. You get to bow to them. You get to go, oh, it was a need for friendship, not a need for coherence and connection. So what I'd like you to do is to have a moment to play with the metaphor idea and start to hear, for those of you who are familiar with NVC, to listen into your metaphor guess. It's for the feelings and needs that are there. And for those of you who aren't familiar with NVC, you don't need your NVC. You don't need any NVC to do this. In the pair exploration, you'll choose an A and a B, and the A will select some small thing that is currently worrying them and share it with B, including the body sensations that arise when A speaks about this issue or thinks about this issue. So I just did that for you guys. I chose my sense of embarrassment about being sick. And B listens. And B, as you're listening, let an image arise for you in response to what A is saying and ask, is it like, so if I were being B to Sarah's A, I would say, is it like you're worried that the image that is arising for me is a sense of like a cloud of noxious green gas coming off of Sarah that she's really worried about, even across the internet. So I would say, is it like that? Is it like that? There's a cloud of noxious green gas? And A will say, yes, that's right, it is, and expand, or say, no, it's not like that at all. It's like this. And then A, please check in with your body to see if your sensations now are the same as you were when A was thinking of the small thing in the beginning. So I wonder if that has a little bit of clarity. If anybody is feeling really confused, could you raise your hand?
I had a question.
Okay.
You used an image guess, and are you encouraging us to do specifically a image that comes up for us, or is that just one of the options of an empathy guess?
I was inviting people to play with a metaphor. And so I was inviting you to play with the image. Because I think most people on the call might be familiar with feelings and needs guesses. And so I'm inviting them to expand their repertoire slightly. But you get to do whatever you want. It's always just a request.
Sarah, give me about 1 minute to finish these breakouts, and then we'll get put into the breakout room. So if you want to share something else, that would be great.
About self-warmth, it's important to know that even if we've never really felt it for ourselves, it's there in our brains just waiting to be awakened, that it's a neurobiological certainty that it's there. Often we can feel warmth for others, but we have a hard time feeling it for ourselves. So one of the important things to do is to notice where you do have an easy time with warmth. George Lakoff wrote, "The biology of empathy allows us to comprehend our connection to each other, to other living things, and to the physical world that supports life." So we may feel compassion and love for nature. We may feel compassion and love for babies. We may feel compassion and love for horses or for dogs or for plants or for beautiful landscapes. Wherever it is that we can feel this, it means that your circuits for self-warmth are present. But sometimes they have never really been used. And it's almost like we're used to pointing the flashlight out, and we need to physically learn to be able to kind of point the flashlight in. So there are some metaphors that make it much easier to understand love and warmth. These metaphors are based on body comfort and physical experiences of warmth and softness, like soft beds, warm beds, a horse's velvet nose, a kitten, a dog's ear. This is an invitation to bring these concepts back to ourselves. We are all worthy of being held with warmth and softness by ourselves and by others. So resonance for the self is what NBC is aiming for when we use the word self-empathy. But if we try to do self-empathy without self-warmth, only with precision, it isn't resonant. And you'll hear this when people are doing those robotic needs guesses. Sarah, are you feeling embarrassed about having a cold because you have a need for a contribution? Might be correct, but there's no warmth in it that lets me have a sense of being really deeply understood and met and welcomed. And if we try to be warm without precision, it's just reassurance and not resonance. So this is a handout that I love. I love this handout. I had a longtime NBC trainer recently say to me, they didn't speak it aloud, but they said to me, "I'm wanting to do reassurance, but I'm remembering this cartoon." So what I mean by reassurance is like if you're time traveling to your younger self and you see that your younger self is scared and frozen and you say, "It's going to be all right." This is warmth and it is reassurance, but it has no resonance because it doesn't have any precision about the child's experience, the inner child's experience. So you can see the moment for resonance is taken. I have a broken heart. You have a broken heart. Of course you have a broken heart. And the movement then into connection is different than being met with warmth without precision. So when we do self-empathy with warmth and self-understanding, our bodies relax. Warm self-empathy brings us self-regulation, the ability to remain in emotional balance. I'll check in with you again, Robin, and see if I should go further.
I think I've got it. I'm going to open your rooms now.
Well, people got a little moment of personal connection. Oh, well, look at the brain in the palm of the hand. I told you before that we'd talk about this again, but here's a picture for you, and you have the access to these slides so that you can use them for whatever you would like. This picture is from Daniel Siegel. So let's add the concept that self-regulation is always integrated other regulation, or Bonnie Badenoch says co-regulation. That whenever we are taking care of ourselves with warmth and precision, we are taking care of ourselves on the model of having experienced it from somebody else. And so hopefully over these weeks, we will have more and more experiences where more people get to be touched by some combination of warmth and precision to begin to open this pathway between the right intentional brain and the right emotional brain. This picture gives you a sense of where we said the thumb was the internal structure of the limbic system when we were talking about this before, and then folding the fingers down over. This picture shows the internal structures of the brain. You can see the brain stem coming up and hooking into the limbic system. And then you can see the hippocampus is the red horn that's coming off of that gray area that's all of the basal nuclei. And then that you can see the amygdala, which is the part of the brain that knows what emotion we're having and also is in charge of emotional memory. We'll learn more about trauma and emotional memory because that's a part of understanding the self-critical voice as well. It's kind of behind the eyeballs deep in the brain. So then the brain in the palm of your hand, when you curl those fingers gently over the limbic system and over the thumb, your fingertips are your prefrontal cortex, and they curl around and nurture your emotional self, letting your emotions be understood and integrated. So when we bring warm resonance to ourselves, we change our lives. A moment of self-compassion can change your entire day. A string of such moments can change the course of your life. A quote by Christopher Germer. We can carry it with us. As we begin to do this work, what we're starting to create, and there's really fun research that shows that if we call ourselves by our own name, you will notice that I was doing that in the work with Yano, where I was saying, will you please tell Yano, I release you from this vow and I revoke this contract. When we call ourselves by our own name, we are creating the resonating self-witness. If we do it with warmth and we bring precision to the table, it's like we're allowing there to be a differentiation between the part of us that can hold ourselves with compassion and the part of us that is feeling the experience. So the beautiful research that has been done recently put some undergraduates into a difficult social situation where they felt awkward. The ones that were directed to call themselves by their own name in self-regulating had less PTSD, less experiences of anxiety or negative self-talk after the experience. So we really want to encourage everybody to begin to do this as a little bit of a practice, to turn to yourself and say, Sarah, are you embarrassed? Are you really wanting contribution? And for Sarah to be able to say, yes, or whatever it is that Sarah's going to say. I have a favorite neuroscientist, favorite epigenetics researcher, and his name is Moshe Jeff, and he is a Canadian, and he works at McGill University, and he says, every cell in your prefrontal cortex carries the signature of the presence or the absence of your mother. So remember, in the very beginning of the call, I said that the children who have an internalized sense of being understood with warmth and precision from the very beginning, these children live longer, have lives where they rate themselves as having higher satisfaction, have lower incidences of disease, and have lower stress overall. Their bodies do not create the same level of cortisol to try to muscle through life, because instead of having to muscle through life, they're walking together with somebody through life. So this is what we're starting to create with this work, with these calls. So what this means is that our brains have learned how to nurture ourselves from our mother, so we may need to relearn and reawaken the right prefrontal cortex if our mom's right prefrontal cortex was not awakened. If no one ever took care of your mother, she never learned how to take care of you. And the mother inside of every cell of your prefrontal cortex may be bewildered about how to nurture your emotional self. So with every experience of resonance, or every time you have a sense of being accompanied, you are cultivating, growing, grafting, and weaving the animals, people, spirits, earth, stars, trees, water, and moon love you into your prefrontal cortex, so that you can begin to resource yourself with your love, with their love, just the way you are, and discover the new integration over the resonant self resonant self-mother or self-witness inside of your own brain. And I love this quote. Falling in love with yourself first does not make you vain or selfish. It makes you indestructible. It can be easier to visualize that you are carrying within you a resonating self-witness. If you have a picture, you can use a picture of anybody from history. I have a friend who uses Abraham Lincoln as their resonating self-witness. Other people use Kuan Yin. Other people have just a strong sense of themselves in present time, in the clothes that they're wearing today, being their own resonating self-witness. So now we're here. We've worked really hard this evening, and we're just starting to create connection and community. I'd love to do a round where we hear each voice that people are willing to speak. So in closing, you can bring a question. You can bring a need that was met for you.
Your mic is open.
Needs met for learning and accompaniment.
Thank you.
I thought it was really helpful to have the idea of thinking about what the critical voice is needing, is trying to get to. Never really thought about it that way before. I thought that was really helpful.
Thank you.
I'm just so excited to learn some right brain language, so hope for me.
Oh, yay.
Time you're mentioning loneliness and then the cells of the brain carrying the care of our mother, tears keep coming. So my need of connection and self-discovery, I'm really surprised at how much that keeps touching me.
The piece on the aloneness, and we don't know, like fish swimming in water. We don't know. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. And thank you all so much for being here. Very, very grateful.